You're listening to Nip Tuck Talk Radio. This is Michelle Garber, and today's guest is board-certified plastic surgeon, Dr. Scott Mosser from San Francisco, California, and our topic today is breast revision surgery. I hope you enjoy the show. Please stay tuned.
What makes me really sad is when people are living with something which is fully improvable, fully fixable. Sometimes I'll see somebody for a revision and they've been needing one for 12 years, and then I give it to them and they are speechless that they waited so long. So I always hate to hear that somebody is, you know, kind of living with something that they don't think works for them very well.
Welcome to the Nip Tuck Coach Radio, your cosmetic surgery connection. Join cosmetic surgery Nip Tuck Coach, beauty expert, and author of Safety First, A Consumer Guide to Cosmetic Surgery, Michelle Garber. Michelle's goal is to empower listeners and help them make safe cosmetic surgery procedure choices. This fun and lively show explores the world of beauty and cosmetic surgery and features expert guests on a variety of topics. No hype. Your host, Michelle Garber, is here today to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic surgery.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Garber. If you don't know me, I'm founder of Nip Tuck Coach, an independent cosmetic procedure consultancy, and I'm a patient advocate. And my goal is to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic procedures by keeping you safe and well-informed so that not only do you get a great result, but you get the best result. And I've also written an ebook called Safety and Beauty, which is the 10 Golden Rules for Safe Cosmetic Surgery, and you can download that for free at my website, which is www.niptuckcoach.com. Breast augmentation continues to be the top cosmetic surgical procedure and has been since 2006. Silicone implants were used in 72%, and saline has gone up 1%, and implants in general have gone up since 2013. And today, we're going to talk about breast revision surgery with San Francisco plastic surgeon Dr. Scott Mosser. Good afternoon, Dr. Mosser.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. Dr. Mosser, so I read a little bit about your bio and your medical career, and it started in Ecuador. How did you become interested in the healthcare system in Ecuador?
You know, it was more serendipitous than anything. I honestly wanted to live a little before I put myself on kind of the one-way long train towards becoming a doctor. And so between college and medical school, I looked around for ways in which I could maybe travel the world and still get a little bit of legitimate experience under my belt. And I actually didn't even think that I would get the Fulbright grant. It's a pretty prestigious thing to receive, and as a college student, it was kind of a long shot. But I applied to study the Ministry of Health and the healthcare system of Ecuador, and lo and behold, got a grant to do a research project, so I was able to accomplished so many goals in just 1 year. I think I fortified my desire to be a doctor. I learned about other cultures. I traveled the world and did the things that young people should to get themselves well-rounded. And I think I became fascinated with regards to being more of a world citizen maybe than just a citizen of a much smaller community. So it was one of the best things that I've ever done in my life.
That sounds amazing. You're really fortunate to have that experience. When did you decide that the plastic surgery was really what you wanted to specialize in?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure if I can pick a particular sort of day or moment, but I can remember that in surgery, in my surgery rotations in medical school, which I did love, and I loved anatomy class, and I just loved the three-dimensional spatial subjects that were out there, I learned in my surgery rotations that the part of surgery that excited me was when everything came back together again. So at the end of surgery, believe it or not, we would do all these things like cardiac surgery and reconnect arteries to the heart and, you know, things that really probably would disproportionately fascinate every other person on earth. But then I would get excited about when we were putting the chest back together and when things were closing up, and it would just feel so complete and so whole again to me that I sort of realized that I wanted to be in the field where you're always putting things back together. Every single surgery is a surgery of in a way reconstruction or rebirth or closure. That's what I find fulfilling.
And then you went to you went on to graduate school to Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, Texas, and Case
That's
Western
correct, yeah.
University in Cleveland, and that's where you completed your internship and 6 years of comprehensive general and plastic surgery training.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And what brought you to San Francisco, and when did you open up your practice in San Francisco?
So I came to San Francisco at the end of my residency. I wanted to do a year of committed fellowship in cosmetic surgery. So the end of the residency was 2004, and I guess I was doing two things. I had lived a bunch of places that I didn't really feel agreed with me very well, so they're perfectly legitimate cities. But for whatever reason, you know, Houston and maybe it was because I grew up in Phoenix with all the bright sunny days, but Houston and then Cleveland, I sort of felt like I needed to see a great American city to see what was at the sort of upper end of what America could have to offer. So I came out to San Francisco to do a fellowship. You know, kind of to kill two birds with one stone, maybe live for 1 year in a wonderful city before deciding where I wanted to settle down, and also honing my aesthetic skills as much as I possibly could. But within literally 1 week of being in the city of San Francisco and every single day feeling like I was on an amazing vacation, I realized this is the place that I wanted to settle down. So I sort of sunk my roots in and have never left. So I came to become a master of cosmetic surgery, and then I sort of just stuck around for which will likely be for the rest of my life.
When did you open up your San Francisco practice?
So it was the 1 year after the fellowship. It was in 2005. So gosh, I'm now completing my 10th year. I'm down the home stretch of the last few months to make it 10-year anniversary as of July.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I've read that you have two special passions in plastic surgery. What are they?
That's right. Well, I would maybe even say three, because cosmetics is definitely a deep passion of mine, and I really, really enjoy all the cosmetic surgery work that I do, and it's what I'm most known for. But, you know, there's a couple of side passions that I find very fulfilling as well. One of them is that I founded a nonprofit group called Destination Hope, and I organize these medical missions in a whirlwind of 3 months. Every single year, I put together a team and all the supplies and equipment needed to create some operating rooms on the other side of the world. Recently, we've been going to the Philippines, but we've gone to a number of different countries. And we do cleft lip and palate surgery. So we're correcting birth defects for about 1 week of very, very intensive hard work. And it's extremely draining, but is absolutely a labor of love. And at the end of that, I am exhausted to the bone and about as happy as I can possibly be. And that's one of the two things. And then the other passion that I've really found meaning in is I'm, you know, getting more and more involved with the transgender community. And I'm actually doing a lot of transgender chest reconstruction work for individuals who have had, you know, the extremely, extremely unlucky circumstance of finding themselves born into the wrong sexed body. So that's work that I find very fulfilling as well. And so I keep myself pretty busy with all the different things that I love to do in my job.
Well, that's wonderful. I really commend you for going and founding the Destination of Hope, and that must be such a rewarding thing.
It is. You know, one of the things that all forms of plastic surgery offer to the surgeon are, you know, a sense of instant gratification. And I'm glad that there's something like that in medicine, because I'm not sure I would be a great doctor at all the different fields that require months and months and months to see the fruition of one's efforts. But, you know, in plastic surgery, standing right there in minutes from when the work was begun, you can see this incredibly dramatic reaction, this dramatic response. And for some people, of course, it's life-changing, like the cleft lip and palate. There is a real sense of impact. There's a real sense of accomplishment when one is able to see right in front of them the work that they've done the prior couple of hours.
Well, this leads right into breast augmentation, because I remember you and I were speaking, and I asked you about why you were so passionate about breast augmentation, and you did mention that it's instant gratification, that you can see right away after you perform the surgery what it's going to look like, and you don't have to wait as some other surgeries where you have to wait until they heal and they transform differently.
Breast augmentation is something for which on the operating room table, right then and there, a surgeon can see what they've accomplished, and I think that's very satisfying for anyone that's inclined towards artistry, is to be able to know that you're only walking out of the door of the operating room if you've really accomplished something that has, you know, created a sense in your gut, in your artistic self, that you've done it, that you've reached an endpoint. And with your own eyes, there's a lot of things that's true for, but certainly for breast augmentation, that's one of them. You know, you can really stand there and say, yeah, mission accomplished, this is done, and we are where we needed to be based on what the patient wanted and what I know is possible.
So that's very rewarding for both you and the patient.
Yeah, indeed. Most definitely. And, you know, a lot of this, of course, is good dialogue. A lot of it is good communication. It's making sure that a patient really, really understands what they're getting themselves into, what are the pros and the cons, that they're understanding their own anatomy. In our practice, we really, really prioritize empowerment with information. And I know there's a lot of different ways for surgeons to have with regards to bedside manner and with regards to their practice philosophy, but in my practice, I feel very strongly that there's a very educational process which is necessary in order for anybody to make a good decision and for there to be very few surprises with regards to the outcome. And so I think as long as a patient is well-educated, a surgeon, of course, is well enough experienced to pick up on anatomic challenges and help a patient through their decisions, things tend to be pretty predictable. When maybe surgeons are making decisions for the patient without really letting them participate, or maybe not telling the patient about the challenges that are in front of them, I think that's when the surprises can happen. And that's always, it's always disappointing to have a patient come to my office from another surgery and be very, very obviously in a situation where something has happened and they had absolutely no idea that the outcome was possible in their situation.
Yeah, that is very disconcerting. And I do hear it from the clients that I see, because I usually see clients that have had problems. And I speak to many clients that are unhappy with their breast augmentation. Either they feel they're too big, or they have rippling, or they have scars that they don't like. I have a friend who's had two revisions, and
wow,
She's still embarrassed with her breasts. I mean, she's really embarrassed. And mm-hmm. She's afraid or reluctant to have another surgery because, yeah, she's afraid. She doesn't really know
right
what's going to happen, though she wants to do it. And I read that, excuse me, that government statistics report, there's a 20% revision rate for breast aug. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's increasing?
Well, it's over decreasing? It's an important statistic to note. And so, again, this is part of the patient education process. Any surgeon that's doing their job really should be sitting the patient down and helping them look into the future with regards to what it means to have a breast augmentation. So there's a lot of different, again, in the greater topic of breast revision, we could be talking about breast reduction, mastopexy, meaning breast lift, or we could be talking about a breast implant. But with regards to breast implants in particular, something that I always try to tell patients is that these are human-made objects that are being placed into the body, and they're very technologically advanced. We're in the fifth generation now, and there are even some implants that are above and beyond the fifth generation technology, but it's still a human-made object, and it's important for anybody that gets anything that's human-made to know that there may very well be a maintenance procedure that's due at some point down the road, whether that would be an artificial heart valve or an artificial hip. Certainly a breast implant is in different ways in that category as well. And so revisions could come from a number of different reasons. There's the uncommon ones that would be right around the time of surgery. That would be like something like a bleeding problem or an infection. That's less than 1 in 100. Outwards from surgery, which would probably be the more likely ones that I would see on referral from another practice, would be a shape issue. Early on, maybe the patient had challenging anatomy, maybe they just had, for some reason, an unpredictable interaction with the implant, but maybe 1 in, I would guess, 25, maybe another 4% would would 4 to 5% would have a shape issue or an implant position issue. Further out from that, there are some things that are known that just have to do with the existence of implants. So over time, there are cumulative possibilities for implants to leak. Now, I know that in the old days, 15 years ago, when we would talk about implants leaking, people would be terrified. They would think that that meant that they were going to get some systemic illness or an autoimmune disease or some sort of a cancer. And while those have all been, by and large, ruled out, and that's not part of a concern for safety for breast implants, implants could possibly leak, whether they're saline or silicone. And if there's any sign of a leak, that's a reason to change out an implant. So it's inconvenient to go back to surgery, but we're not talking about something that's life and death. We're just talking about a reason to go back. And that's cumulative over time. So if we're talking about a revision rate within just a year or two, it would be much lower than 20%. But if we're talking about a revision rate over a longer period of time, like 10 years or more, then, yeah, possibly one in five women could absolutely very well need to go back to surgery for some sort of a touch-up. And I think that that's definitely not indicative of a failure of the technology, but is indicative of the fact that a surgeon needs to be having very forthright conversations with anybody that they talk to about the surgery so that they know that's kind of what they're in some ways signing up for, that's got to be okay. If somebody did not think that it was at all acceptable on the scope of their life to have a second surgery somewhere down the road, either to change out the implants or to replace them for a leak or any other concern, then that's something they should learn early. They should know in a conversation with a doctor that is possible so they could opt out and would not set themselves up for some sort of an unexpected circumstance.
Now, are there certain implants that have a tendency to rupture more?
Great question. And what we learned in the past was that for saline implants, there is a higher likelihood for them to rupture if they are underinflated, meaning this is quite a while ago, you know, 10 or more years ago, but we used to sort of think that it was maybe a better idea to underinflate these implants because perhaps it was overinflating them that caused a problem and was maybe stretching them too much, and maybe that was causing them to leak. When saline implants are underinflated, the problem is that they can create little folds, just like imagine, I don't know, like a water balloon that doesn't have much water in it, or maybe better would be described like a little Ziploc baggie with just a little bit of water in it. It would naturally form little wrinkles on the side of it if it doesn't have a whole lot of water pressure. And those little wrinkles, over time, over years, rubbing on themselves, create little pinholes. And so, again, probably about 10 to 12 years ago, we learned that saline implants need to be slightly overinflated so that they're less likely to form these little wrinkles. And that's pretty much the standard of care now. Almost any surgeon would inflate the saline implants on the sort of upper end of the range that would be appropriate, and that would reduce the risk of deflation. But, you know, more or less, as we come to accept that it's probably about 1% per implant per year that's going to end up having some sort of a leak. Again, that's something that more than anything needs to be just told to the patients up front so that they can just be prepared for the possibility at some point down the line that another surgery would be necessary for that reason.
Are you still using a lot of saline implants?
I'm really not a whole lot. Saline implants, I really deeply believe that the silicone implants are living up to the safety that the FDA has established, and that, you know, we were being told all over the world, even while, I don't know if everybody that would be listening to this would know the history, but about 8 years ago, the silicone implants came back on the market. And for about 15 years before that, we could not use silicone implants for cosmetic purposes. You could use them after cancer, but you couldn't use them for cosmetics in America. And they had been taken off the market because of a possible scare with regards to them having some interaction with the immune system, that maybe they were causing autoimmune diseases. And so they were removed off the market, and for 15 years, every woman that got cosmetic breast augmentation got saline. Saline implants definitely do not have as natural of a feel. For sure, they have more of a water bag sort of a feel to them. They move more like a liquid of low viscosity. They're much more likely to have ripples, but that's all we had at that time. Then the silicone implants, based on some very, very good studies, were shown to be safe and unproblematic, and so they came back on the market for cosmetic use. So that was in about 2006, I believe. And so there was a little bit of time for patients to once again get back to being comfortable with them and realizing that, yes, indeed, these are safe. But, you know, now the safety is very clearly established. And anybody that's interested in the most natural feel is going to pick a silicone implant. So silicone implants are by far the most popular. In my practice, they're probably about, gosh, upwards of more than 90% of the implants that I place. And while silicone implants also can rupture, the rupture is certainly less dramatic in that when a saline implant ruptures, the breast appears to deflate pretty rapidly over the period of just a couple of days. So a saline breast leak is it feels like an emergency for a patient because they lose all of their volume very quickly. A silicone implant may leak. But the silicone implants in the modern era have a quality to them that's called cohesive. And what it really means is that silicone implants feel like they're liquidy. They feel like they might be full of something that feels like maybe honey or so of liquid consistency. But if you were to cut them open, it would be much more like jelly. It's a solid substance or semi-solid. And so the belief is that even if silicone implants were to spring a little bit of a leak, the actual amount of liquid silicone that would come out of the implant is very, very minimal and is of much better quality than the silicone that was used 20 to 30 years ago. It's very, very pure, biologically inert, and probably doesn't even interact with our biology almost at all, if at all. And so there's a lot of debate about whether or not silicone implants whether the rupture is something that should be of concern or whether it is consequential on any level or inconsequential. Most surgeons will basically advise patients, you know, not to go overboard and get a whole bunch of expensive studies to monitor their silicone gel-filled implants, but instead to just monitor them clinically, meaning be normal and observant about one's breasts. And if there's a significant shape change or some sort of a symptom that seems confusing or problematic, or if a patient sustains a trauma like a car accident and they just want to be sure, that would be the time to do an expensive study like an MRI to evaluate whether or not there's likely to be a leak. But in other circumstances, it's probably not necessary to be there's no clear epidemiologic proof that performing MRIs, for example, every other year is really a cost-effective thing for the American population to be doing for silicone implant evaluation.
So if the implant does leak, how quickly do they have to have it removed and go into surgery?
So if it's found to be leaking, it would be usually something that would be discovered on an MRI exam, for example, or maybe initially on either a mammogram or an ultrasound of the breast, there would be a suspicion, and then it would be confirmed by MRI. And really, very commonly, a patient won't have symptoms. They'll maybe have a tiny bit of a silicone implant leak with a bit of silicone around the shell. The shell is the soft, rubbery part of the outer implant. So you could have a little bit of implant outside of that. But generally speaking, the silicone is still contained within the soft capsule, it's called, the very soft scar tissue that the body always creates around an implant to kind of wall it off. That's a natural response to any foreign material. So you may have some silicone within this capsule, but not really floating around the body to a significant degree in most cases. So it's not an emergency in terms of like overnight getting back to the operating room. Certainly once somebody knows that they have a bit of a leak, it's smart to change out the implants at the next convenient time. But that's something that could be done easily within, you know, a week to a month to whatever time in the short term is convenient to the person's schedule. It's definitely not considered a medical emergency, but it's definitely considered something that would be recommended to move forward with as soon as it's convenient.
And what about capsular contracture? Let's talk a little bit about that. What causes that? What are the symptoms? And how do we remedy? What's the treatment?
So it's that's a great semi-enigmatic outcome with regards to breast augmentation. And there's a lot that's known about it, and there's a lot that is not known about it. But a capsular contracture is, remember I just sort of said that every woman that has breast implants in place has a natural capsule around the implant. So that's in every single woman with implants. And these capsules are usually very, very thin. You wouldn't even know they're there. They're very soft, and it's the body's response to a foreign material. In some patients, for reasons that aren't 100% clear, this capsule can start to firm up, and it can start to harden. And then it can actually draw the implant in an upward direction a bit. And if it gets to an advanced stage, it could become uncomfortable, and it can form a significant roundness to the appearance of the breast. And many of us have seen these. Not everybody knows for sure what they're looking at, but they know that they're looking at somebody that looks augmented. When somebody has an advanced stage capsular contracture, they have a real firmness to their breasts, and obviously it's an unfavorable outcome. Now that's a minority, but it does occur. It's always disheartening for me to see somebody that has been living with a capsular contracture for a long time, because it's a highly fixable situation. In this day and age, we absolutely have the tools to remove that capsule or place the implant in a new location within the breast that is outside of the problematic capsule. We have materials that we can place in the lower breast to make it very unlikely that the capsule can come back, which I think it would be good for maybe you and I to talk a little bit about in a few minutes, but I'd like momentarily to get back to in plastic surgery, our best guesses as to why capsules occur. What we know about capsules is they're not very capsular contractures. What we know about capsular contractures, the firmness, is that it doesn't happen very often. You know, probably on the order of 6 to 8% or so. So it's there, but it's most likely that someone will never have this problem. They seem to occur more likely through the incisions that may be more contaminated with bacteria, so through the armpit incision and through the incision which is around the areola, which probably has the implant coming in contact with some milk ducts and some bacteria from the milk ducts. So there may be a bacterial component, maybe it's a low-level infection of some sort that's playing a role. Capsular contractures are less likely through the incision in the lower part of the breast, and they're less likely if the implant is placed beneath the muscle. Again, not 100% sure why that is. Maybe it's because the muscle is just kind of continuously doing a bit of massage on the implant, and it's helping keep it soft as a result of that. The causes, and there's other causes as well, anything that can create a temporary inflammatory state of the breast. If somebody is unfortunate enough that they're in that less than 1% category and they have a bleed around the time of surgery, that's somebody that could get some firmness around the implant as well. But in all cases, it's a fixable situation. Used to be that we didn't have great tools, and you just sort of, there were all sorts of crazy things that surgeons would do to try and fix capsular contractures, and I'm glad that we've left. One can create a new space for the implant that's completely fresh, still within the breast, still within the right location, still beneath the muscle. It's called a neo pocket, and they can place one of a variety of materials in the lowest part of the breast that, for reasons we don't fully understand yet, but seems to form a very powerful protective component and prevent a capsular contracture from happening again. Probably never want for a woman to fret because she has some firmness around her implants. It's as I mentioned, always really sad for me to have a patient come in to see me and they've been sort of fretting and stressed out about a result for 4 to 6 years from another surgeon just because they were scared, to continue the dialogue and figure out what the solution might be.
He actually rejects the implant?
You know, that's a phrase that is used a lot, but ultimately it's just a simplification of the different physiologic processes that could occur. So capsular contracture is the is the most common thing that could occur that people will use a shorthand and say, your body is rejecting these implants. And I guess in a sense it kind of is, because when the body rejects something, it creates a lot of scar tissue around it. And if that's what's happening to the implant, well, then maybe that's a convenient way to kind of think about it. I would say I would only use, personally as a surgeon, I would only use the concept of rejection if and this would be very rare, but if a patient needed a revision and then that didn't work and then one or two more revisions and the very, very best hands and the very, very best techniques were resulting in a body, you know, just continuously causing trouble with an implant, whether it was a shape issue, whether it was a contraction. I mean, in my career, there have been a couple of times, and that's out of many, many hundreds to probably more than 1,000, there have been a couple of times in which it really did sort of seem like no matter what we would try, a body just didn't want to have implants in place. But
oh,
by
how disappointing
and large,
to the patient. That must have been
disappointing absolutely.
To the patient.
And, you know, to an empathetic surgeon who has real, true compassion, it's very, very difficult for everybody that's involved. But fortunately, that's very, very rare. I don't use words like rejecting implants because really there are solutions to these problems. And that's just an oversimplified kind of fear-based way of thinking about things instead of really digging in and talking about what's going on and what can be done about it.
So when a patient comes to you and needs a revision, I understand that any type of surgical revision is more complicated.
It's true.
Than the initial.
Whenever you have scar tissue in the area, you have to deal with, you know, the presence of tissue that is being operated on for a second time. The human body heals things. Who knows, you know, wherever it was back in the days of evolution where this was determined, but somehow our healing is determined to be almost like pouring cement on something, biological cement. That's sort of what scar tissue is. Whenever we have a surgery, whenever we have an incision, whenever we have an injury, our body heals it by kind of putting a form of cement into an area in a way. It's fibrous tissue. It's created by our cells, but it's very firm. And when any surgeon goes back in to do another surgery, they have to address this tissue and they have to think about what they're going to do when they encounter the scar tissue which is in place. One of the techniques that I mentioned briefly was something called a neo-pocket. And that's a great way of addressing scar tissue. So maybe a little difficult to communicate with words, but I'll give it a try. When you, for example, have somebody with a capsule, they've got some firmness around the implant, and you want to put a new implant in, but you don't want it to be affected by that scar tissue at all. What a surgeon can do is they can place the implant very carefully just above the capsule. So they create a new space that's just above that capsule, exactly in the same location, and then they pull out the old implant, they flatten the capsule down to the chest, and it actually stays in there, and then they've got a nice new space that's uninvolved with all that old scar tissue, and a new implant is placed into that location, and it's in most cases able to behave as though a first surgery was never done. So there are ways around this scar tissue, but certainly, as you can imagine, that's tougher than not having to deal with it. So it is always a little bit more challenging first initial surgery, I would say, in almost every single case.
Do some patients have just a propensity to get this capsular contracture, or that is not really related?
No, it's absolutely true. You're absolutely right, and that's an insightful question. So it's known that if somebody gets a capsular contracture, that they have a higher than average risk of getting it in the other breast, and if a capsular contracture is repaired, they have a higher than average, a higher risk of getting it again than somebody who never had one. So there is an element possibly of the environment, you know, as I mentioned, maybe a low-level bacterial contamination of some sort, hard to say. But it also almost for sure has to do with the person's own biology and whether or not their body would react in an exaggerated way to a foreign material. So that's a component of it as well. And, you know, I think every plastic surgeon in America wished that we had better hard and fast answers to these questions. We sort of know what the data shows, but we don't have 100% answers on exactly why this is occurring. But thank goodness, at least we've got some tools to fix it.
Have you ever advised a patient not to get an implant?
Yeah. I mean, the correct decision to do plastic surgery is really based on a marriage between anatomy, expectations, and techniques. So really a three-way combination between those different elements. And if you don't combine those accurately and carefully as a surgeon, then you're going to end up with an unhappy patient. For any doctor, any surgeon that's a compassionate, ethical individual, it's excruciating to have an unhappy patient for any reason. So any surgeon that wants to do the right thing is going to examine the patient's physique, look for challenges, clearly communicate those challenges to the patient, and also very, very carefully listen to the words coming out of the patient's mouth with regards to what they're hoping for and what they're expecting. If it doesn't match up, then the surgeon's role is to tell the patient very clearly that what they're hoping for and what's achievable is not going to line up. And if a patient... In some patients then will revise their expectations, and they'll say, okay, well, thank you very much for being honest. I think I can still live with that result, even though it's not my greatest dream of a result. But other people, will then realize that surgery isn't for them, and the surgeon will realize that surgery isn't for them, and the best decision of all will be to not move forward. If a consultation's done correctly, then it's still a successful consultation, even if surgery isn't performed, because communication and learning and good decision-making is the goal of a good consultation.
Oh, communication is key. But I do
Absolutely.
Want to go back now a little bit to the revision breast augmentation and some of the advances that have been made over the years compared to where they were, say, 10 or even 5 years ago.
Absolutely. So I'm going to tell you these crazy stories now of what people used to do. Let's talk about capsular contracture, because I think that's one of the places where that and maybe implant malposition. When the implants are too close to one another towards the center, you can get some lifting of skin in the center of the chest, and then people call that the uniboob, or plastic surgeons will call that a medial malposition. But you can have, in certain circumstances, implants that could be a little bit too high, a little bit too low, sometimes a little bit too far outwards. All of those, fortunately, are not common, but they do occur, and those are fortunately very fixable these days with the tools we've got, whereas in the past they were not very fixable. Getting back to the capsular contracture and what was done in the past, it's almost just unbelievable, but some of the surgeons in maybe 20 years ago or so this is in the modern world, ancient history, to fix a firm implant, they would take a patient to anesthesia and they would just grab the breast really hard, trying to create cracks in the capsule.
Ooh.
And it wouldn't injure the patient, but it sure sounded brutal. And so then they would be able to kind of create ruptures in the capsule. It was called a closed capsulotomy. And statistics showed that it didn't work. It's probably no big surprise. These capsules would recur and they would be problematic. So we compare stuff like that to the surgery full of finesse that we're doing these days, and it's sort of no wonder that it was hopeless to try and solve a problem that way. But the modern things that have come out are a series of materials that can be placed in the lower breast that make it very strong and also very resistant to hardening, very resistant to the recurrence of capsular contracture. And there's a whole bunch of these different materials that are out. They are biologically compatible materials. Some of them come from biology. There is a material that comes from a deep layer of pig skin, one that comes from a deep layer of cow skin, one that comes from human cadaver skin, and then there's my favorites are the ones that don't come from animals and biological origins. There's a synthetic called Ceri, S-E-R-I, that is, actually it's not fully synthetic, it is a form of silk that is very, very purified, that is a very compatible material, and eventually the body will dissolve and will replace with its own scar tissue. These things have really changed the world. In the past, for capsular contracture, one would just sort of have to go in there and remove the capsule and put the implant back in and, kind of light a candle and hope for the best, and many, many of them returned. For implant position problems, they would have to go in there and throw in a bunch of stitches and try and sew things up in a way that created a new shape and hope that everything held. And a lot of the time it didn't. A lot of the time the implants would sort of settle back into their wrong position. But if we can place these materials, it stays. And it's very reliable. And it's very strong. And I've found some very fulfilling experiences with difficult circumstances. That part of it probably is technique, but part of it is really owed to the advances in technology that I can now use to secure a result on the table and know that that's still going to be the result that a patient will have 6 months to 1 year to 5 years down the line.
You're using other materials that are put in the breast, right, to
Correct.
Help the implant stay so it
Correct.
Doesn't move around, or in the case of capsular contracture, so the capsule doesn't form again. So these
that's
are
right.
other materials. Okay.
And these are all revisionary surgeries. So in an original surgery, we wouldn't do this. And most women, of course, would never even know of or have the need for any of these materials because these complications are rare. But for the patients that are affected by them, what they really want is a secure, reliable solution. I'm sure that any of us could imagine that if somebody's going back to surgery unexpectedly, that's certainly no fun for a patient to have to face. But what they really want is that they're never going to have to do it again, or the chance for them to have to go back is very, very low. That whatever solution that we've got is a workable solution and a reliable solution. And I think we, in the past, you know, again, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we may not have been able to really say that very confidently, but in the modern era, we are. And it's very, very nice to be able to offer that to people who are already facing the stress of, you know, an unexpected revisionary surgery.
Are you going in through the same scars?
Almost always. We want to try not to create any new scars unless we have to. There's the occasional situation where a patient has too small of an incision, maybe around the areola, or certainly an armpit incision is very limited for what one can do with revisionary surgery. So those are circumstances where the surgeon may be compelled to create a new incision. But as long as the incision is wide enough, most revisions can be done through the original incision. Well, I should say, as long as it's on the breast. The armpit incision, the axillary incision, is not a very good incision for revision surgery. And most surgeons would tell the patients upon selecting that one that it's kind of a one-time incision. If they ever needed another surgery, they wouldn't be usually using the axillary incision for large silicone gel-filled implants.
Now, there seems to be a lot, a lot of times women don't like their scars, and they have to go in for scar revision. How often do you see that in your practice, and why do you think that happens? Is that the body's healing, or does it have to do with the surgeon's technique, or is it a combination, or it's a really unknown factor?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, in my practice, I don't see that almost ever. We will have patients who have mastopexy incisions, for example. That's a breast lift. Those are much more extensive, and those are more likely to have a need for a revision or a breast reduction, of course, a much more extensive incision, and there's regions that can get thickened or regions that can become wide and may need a revision. So those are circumstances where it is more likely that a patient may want a revision. For breast augmentation, I'm almost never seeing a patient that is distressed by her scars and needing a revision. But I would think most plastic surgeons would be pretty obsessive and pretty meticulous about skin closure. And it is true that certain types of biology, especially oily skin, what we call sebaceous skin, oily skin can lead to much, much thicker scars. But, you know, I would say that if anyone is distressed by their scars, then they probably should be getting a second opinion, because most of the time, if a scar is distressing, I feel that it should be able to be improved.
And what about recovery from revision surgery? Is it longer than the primary surgery?
This may be the one good thing about having a recovery, is that for breast augmentation, you're commonly not doing as much of the uncomfortable part of the work through a revisionary procedure. So the more uncomfortable part of a breast augmentation is the work that's done on the muscle. A small amount of the muscle needs to be modified in a way to allow for roundness in the lower breast. And on the first surgery, that's done, and that's where a lot of the postoperative discomfort comes from. With a revisionary surgery, most commonly you don't need to do that. So while patients would report that a primary breast aug, meaning the first surgery breast aug, would be like a 5 or a 6 on a scale of 1 to 10 for pain, most women would report that a revisionary surgery would be more like a 4 or so on a scale of 1 to 10 for pain. Now, the milestones for recovery are still about the same because the rate of the body healing is the same no matter what kind of surgery you're having. So it would be about 3 weeks or so of not doing any cardio activities and then getting back up to 5 or 6 weeks until one can get back to the gym and do yoga and Pilates and all the things that would really require higher resistance sorts of activities.
So it's still a long recovery.
It's, well, in terms of time, same time,
right.
Same milestone. But in terms of discomfort, it's better.
Well, that's good to know.
Unfortunately, yeah, at least there's the small consolation of having
a revision surgery. And you said earlier that revisions, once you have a revision, you should not need another one, correct?
I wouldn't necessarily say that unless I knew a clinical situation. Every single sort of predictive, prognostic, looking to the future thing that is said would always have to be compared to a clinical situation, to a person's body and to what's going on with them. There are patients that are extremely challenging. Some of the most challenging patients that I treat with breast surgery are the patients that have lost a huge amount of body weight, and they have, you know, sheets of skin on their body that's excessive in their arms, in their breasts, in their torso, and this is skin that has deeply lost its elasticity and doesn't behave like skin from other patients in any way, shape, or form. I would say those patients are really challenging, and one certainly would hope that if they needed a revision, that you'd be able to predict what the skin could do, but you can't always. What I think that surgeon's role is to describe to the patient what's known and what's not known, so the patient can go into any surgery knowing kind of what they're up against. Sometimes I can tell patients, you know, if it's like a capsular contracture, if it's an implant malposition, you know, I can usually say, yeah, we are absolutely going in to solve this problem with the next surgery. If it's a patient that has massive weight loss and they've gotten a breast lift and it looked beautiful for 3 months, but then their skin relaxed again and it drooped down and they need a revision, you know, I would say you still got the same skin. You know, we'll still try and get a perfect result, and we're just going to hope that with a retightening that the tissues will behave more predictably a second time around. But I think it's mainly a communication thing. A surgeon needs to let a patient know what they know and what they don't know. And then a patient gets to decide, you know, what the best course of action is given that information.
Now, with the newest implants, what is the time span for replacement compared to the old ones?
Or is that hard to tell because they're so new? Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much where I was going. And also, when we compare something that's out to something that has been removed from the market because it was technologically inferior, it's really a true apples to oranges comparison. Well, I say, first of all, patients don't have to have their implants changed just because the calendar days have gone by, meaning you don't have to change your implants just because you've reached a 10-year mark. But having said that, most surgeons are saying that implants probably have about a 10-year lifespan, and if a patient is going in for some other surgery on their breasts anyway around 10 years, that they probably would want to change out their implants. But if implants are not causing trouble and 10 years have passed or 15 or even 20 years have passed and there's really no issues with the implants, then there's nothing that really says that they need to be replaced.
You recommend that the patient, if they are 10 or 15 years old, does have an MRI to get them checked? Or if they feel fine, just forget about it?
So, good question. We don't have data on this. So any recommendation from a doctor would sort of be the doctor's gut level feel of a recommendation. What I would say is it's probably a good idea to get a really good physical exam by a plastic surgeon, maybe even a plastic surgeon that knows them if the one that did the surgery is still around. It makes sense to go ahead and get an MRI. I guess it's a difficult situation when you're exactly in the one that you brought up. You know, is there a magical time in which every single woman in America who has a breast augmentation should get an MRI just because time has passed? And we really don't have an answer for that yet. I don't think that anyone really knows whether 10, 15, or 20 years. But what I would say is for any woman that's 10 years and beyond, if there's any issues with her breasts, if there's any shape concerns, or if there's even just a psychological concern where she's lying awake at night and wondering if there's trouble, then that's exactly what those sorts of studies are for. And if it can even offer some peace of mind,
right,
then
I
would absolutely
say that. Peace of mind, yes.
Yeah, and I think there's a real role for that. The problem is that MRIs can also be wrong. They can be wrong in two different directions. They can miss a leak, and they're pretty accurate, but even still, they can miss a leak, and they can also tell you you have a leak when you don't. And so that's where the problem comes in, because if we were giving MRIs to every single woman in America, we would be doing tens of thousands of surgeries that were totally unnecessary, because a study had told us that something was up when clinically it looked like there was absolutely no problem. So, you know, all of these gray zone decisions in medicine need to be taken with what we call a clinical correlation. We need to look at the patient, talk to the patient, understand their physical and psychological needs and findings, and then we just make the best decision we possibly can for each individual. But it's true that if we did an MRI on every single woman in America, we'd have some false positives, in which case a lot of people would get unnecessary surgery, and that in some senses may be just as bad.
Well, that's really good to know. And I did want to touch on how to choose a good revision surgeon. What are some of the questions that listeners can ask the surgeon regarding to revisions in order to choose the right surgeon for them?
Of course, there's two big questions. One is, of course, are they board certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery? I mean, there's a lot of medical professions that are sort of dabbling in cosmetics, like Botox and injections, and you know, there's different specialties that do
Don't
eyelid
get
surgery
me started.
And can do them. Oh, I can bet. But you know, in breast surgery, there is no one who is qualified in the world of medicine to do aesthetic breast surgery other than a board-certified plastic surgeon from the American Board of Plastic Surgery. So there's no gray zone here whatsoever. That is the only credentialing body that offers a true level of credentialing for this particular type of surgery. So that's the first question. Number two is, you know, general questions about how often the surgeon sees the exact situation which is being brought in front of him or her. But, you know, to answer your question, I'm not sure you specifically asked me for questions that a patient can ask a surgeon, so I wanted to give you a couple. But I actually think the best advice I could give somebody is to pay very careful attention to the quality of the communication. Because you're getting into, if you're having a revision, you're getting into an already difficult situation with somebody that you're, of course, hoping is an expert. And number one, you really, really need to like that person, and you need to feel like you're safe in their hands. So you should really, some of this is trusting your gut and trusting that you really feel like you're in the presence of somebody that wants to empower you with good information, wants to take you on as a partner through this difficult journey, and you really feel like they are giving you explanations and choices that are well communicated and seem very sensible. If you're in the room and you feel like with your surgeon that you really like them, that you would be glad to go through something that may be a bit, you know, of a difficult experience for you with that exact sort of a person, and that you feel like while, you know, there you are in their consultation room and they are taking all the time in the world that it takes to make you feel comfortable and prepared for what lies ahead, then that's probably the sort of personality that they're going to exhibit through a revisionary procedure. And boy, everybody hopes that the revision works, of course, but if for some reason it doesn't meet the expectations of the surgeon and the patient, then certainly they should have a wonderful relationship going into it. They should be able to meet that challenge together, just like any two individuals dealing with any challenge, and you should really feel like the surgeon's got your back and they really want what's best for you, and they really, really want to spend time and talk to you about everything that you need to know. So
that's,
I'm not sure the specific
advice.
Questions.
That
yeah, I really
advice.
Think it's a trust your gut
yeah,
on
no,
a
that,
lot of
that
this.
That really
but,
is great advice.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of good surgeons out there. There's a lot, you know, if you don't, it's you'll know when you know, which is a weird thing to say, but if you don't really feel that solid sense of comfort in your gut, then that's what second opinions are for. And you just keep meeting people until you sort of feel like you've met somebody that you want to go through a journey with.
I think that's great advice because, yes, we should trust our instincts more. And I think sometimes we get feelings in our gut and we don't mm-hmm. always trust what we feel. And then we go back and we go have another consult or sometimes, you know, you want to purchase something and you get a feeling in your gut and then you end up going back to the same thing as well, one that you saw. So I think that we have to, as humans, we have to learn more to trust our guts. And especially
right.
when you're dealing with something as delicate as revision surgery or any plastic surgery, that
absolutely.
If you have a feeling that something's not right between you and the surgeon, then it's time to seek another opinion. And possibly that's
true.
Not the right surgeon for you.
Some of the marketing around plastic surgery has almost given the public a perception that plastic surgeons can have, you know, a different office experience or an eccentric personality or maybe be more distant. And, you know, I kind of feel like, no, a patient really should feel like they are connecting with their surgeon. You know, even if it's in, what some seem to think is a magical field like plastic surgery, I think you still need to have a surgeon with really decent bedside manner and really good communication skills. So I would not let Hollywood's description of what a plastic surgeon should be affect what we all really know, you know, they really should be towards their patients, which is a really good doctor and a really good communicator and listener.
I think that's great. And yes, I do agree. I think that a lot of people, they're afraid sometimes to communicate to their plastic surgeon because they do have this feeling of intimidation. And what you just said it's wonderful that you believe that, and that's, I'm sure, how you are with your patients. And that's great to hear. Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Mosser. We are running out of time. Dr. Mosser's practice is located at 450 Sutter Street, number Suite 1400 in San Francisco. And his telephone number is 415-398-7778. And what is your website?
It's www.drmosser.com, spelled with a D-R. So drmosser.com.
And I want to thank everyone for listening. Please follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest, and niptuckcoach.com. And you can email me at info@niptuckcoach. And remember, you only have one face and one body. Choose wisely. Have a beautiful weekend.
Join us next week for another exciting program about the world of cosmetic surgery and beauty. To learn more about Michelle Garber, go to www.niptuckcoach.com. To consult with Michelle directly, call 415-494-7211.